Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome. Happy Monday to you. Got a great big Monday show here for you on Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And this hour we discuss which moral teaching of the Catholic Church you might have a disagreement with or a problem with. If you have that, give us a call, 888-318-7884. Is there a teaching that you reject? 888-318-7884. Or maybe it's just something that you are not sure whether it's an absolute moral teaching or not. But if you have a moral teaching you're struggling with or that you have given up on and you just reject what the church teaches, 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour is Trent Horn. He's the author of many things, but his most recent book is What the Saints Never Said, Pious Misquotes and the Subtle Heresies They Teach You. Trent Horn, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for being with us. Are you tired? Because I know you've been traveling. You're going to be okay?
I think I'm somewhat recovered, because nothing's a great refresher from international travel than returning home to a house with lovable toddlers and infants. That was a treat to be able to go home and see my family after a about two-week-long pilgrimage in the Holy Land that I just led. And that was a wonderful experience. Took 45 people, went all over the Holy Land, spent Easter in Jerusalem. I actually got to spend Easter. I was the only one who woke up early enough to do this at Mass that was celebrated at the tomb of Jesus at the Holy Sepulchre.
Wow. Wow. So, isn't that something, Trent? What a great privilege to be able to do that.
It was. The Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem celebrated Mass in Latin, and we were all, I was there super early, so I managed to actually get a wooden pew to sit on. Everyone else was just kind of standing around the tomb. But it was great. The Eastern Orthodox were actually celebrating Palm Sunday in the back of the tomb, and they decided for one reason or another to be extremely loud, chanting in bells during our homily and other important parts. I'm not exactly sure why. So that was the only most interesting part. But otherwise, it's just great. Everyone just singing hallelujah, processing around the tomb of Jesus, basically.
Praise God. That's beautiful. Yeah. And we did a little pre-show before for folks who watch on Facebook or YouTube. And I was just mentioning, we don't have to go too much into this, but you do have a really nice article in the Catholic Answers magazine online about the tomb of Jesus and why there's very, very good reason to believe that the tomb that is there at the front there of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is, in fact, the tomb in which Jesus was placed and rose from the dead.
Yes, I talk about this in relation to the other tomb of Jesus in Jerusalem, the one that Protestants prefer that's called the Garden Tomb. In actuality, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in the Old City of Jerusalem, we know it was built in the 4th century outside of the old 1st century walls of Jerusalem. Corresponds to what the Bible says, Jesus was crucified and buried outside of the city. Also, the church historian Eusebius in the 4th century tells us that the church was built on the site of a pagan temple that had been erected in the 2nd century to try to keep Christians away from where they were worshiping Jesus. But that temple served as an unintended marker to remind people where Jesus was buried. So I talk about all that. That's in the article. I believe it's called Mystery of the Two Tombs, and it's on Catholic Answers Magazine online.
Yeah, it's a good one. And I love the fact, it's kind of I don't know if it's an irony or if it's just the way God works, that a Roman emperor would try to obscure the tomb of Jesus and basically build a giant marble landmark so that for hundreds of years people would know exactly where it is.
Yes. I think that maybe it was, and I'm not even going to try to cite who it is because I'm going to get it wrong based on my book, What the Saints Never Said. But someone once said that coincidences are God's sense of humor.
Yeah.
So I think God displays his divine humor through his providence and through these kinds of coincidences.
Coincidences and Jerry Lewis.
And and providentially working all things to good, as he promises us in Romans chapter 8.
Someone online asks, how's the Council of Trent going? Any Nth Metal members?
Oh, yes. So the Council of Trent, not the C-O-U-N-C-I-L, not the 16th century council, but the council, C-O-U-N-S-E-L, as in you know, trying to give you advice. The Council of Trent is my new podcast. It's available at trenthornpodcast.com. You can get it for free on iTunes. Just search for Council of Trent, C-O-U-N-S-E-L, Council of Trent Podcast on iTunes. We do a new episode every week. And it's just my advice for people how to defend and explain the faith in everyday life. Also, sorry, let me forward here a little bit more. At trenthornpodcast.com, you can subscribe and be a premium member. You can get access to episodes other people don't get. You can submit questions to me, be part of live video chat sessions that'll be coming soon. And I think at the one of the levels, at the I think it's the silver level, you can get a T-shirt with my face on it that will make people say, "Who is that?" on your T-shirt.
So.
And there are nth metal. Nth metal is the highest level, that because that is the strongest metal in the multiverse.
No,
of DC Comics.
DC Comics.
DC Comics. Or at least it's one of the most powerful.
Yeah, more powerful than unobtainium. I don't think so.
I don't know about unobtainium's anti-magical properties, but nth metal is very good at repelling magic.
I got you. Okay,
that's why Hawk Girl wields it in her mace.
Good old Hawk Girl. You never see much of her anymore. Is she on any of them? She's not in any of the DC movies. Come on, DC.
She's not in the DC movies. She had a brief appearance on Legends of Tomorrow.
Yeah.
And also on a crossover on The Flash and Arrow. So when I'm not studying theology and apologetics, I enjoy comic books, both in their print form, movies, and television serials.
Our topic this hour with Trent. Which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? Is there something in the sexual teaching of the Catholic Church that bothers you, that you have decided, nope, that's not for you? Give us a call, 888-318-7884. Maybe something having to do with the Catholic Church's teachings on life and death. Maybe the Catholic Church's teaching on war, the Catholic Church's moral teachings on economics and money. Which do you reject? 888-318-7884. We're not encouraging anybody to reject them, just so I don't want you to think you got to come up with one. It's perfectly okay to say, I hold and believe everything that the Catholic Church holds and believes, and I think you're on good, solid ground if you do that. But if you do not hold and believe everything that the Catholic Church holds, which ones do you reject? Which of these moral teachings doesn't pass muster with you? 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. As far as moral teachings go, I think the most successful moral teaching, I'm exaggerating probably, but the Catholic Church's teachings on war and warfare have like just seeped right into the popular mind, so that I think a lot of people don't even know that when they talk about just war, when they talk about justice in war, and when they talk about, you know, all these different aspects of modern understanding of the laws of war, that they're basically talking about things that the Catholic Church has been working out for, I guess, about 1600 years.
Yeah, we first see this articulated in the work of St. Augustine, that most people attribute just war theory to him. And that had a major influence in the Western world for for this idea that there, you know, it seems like an oxymoron at first, that there are war crimes. That, I mean, in war, you know, you can kill people, but there's some times where you kill people where it's a crime and other times it's not. Whereas in many other cultures, in the New World, for example, there's a lot of archaeological evidence that certain Native American tribes practice total war. And we see other cultures around the world, this idea of total war, which is, if I go to battle against someone else, it's scorched earth and I just demolish them. In fact, in the Old Testament, God had to restrain the Israelites against practicing total war. So he told them, you know, when you went to war against a pagan tribe, you had to take the booty, you know, their sacred vessels and property, and you would have to consecrate it to God. You couldn't keep it for yourself because of it, the pagan influences related to it. And when the Israelites disobeyed this command, bad things happened to them. But you're right. The church, most people, I think many people agree with the church's teachings on just war, though they disagree about certain areas of applying it. One of the biggest ones would be the use of nuclear weapons, for example.
Okay, well, you're going to have to clarify that for me, Trent.
Well, so,
go ahead.
The church speaks about the dangers of nuclear weapons, and one of the requirements for just war is that a weapon you use can't create greater evils than the evil that it fights. Though the church has not categorically said the use of nuclear weapons is always wrong, it leans very heavily in the description of just war theory that the use of nuclear arms in many cases, or most cases, would constitute unjust warfare, whether it, you know, because it's targeting civilians or it creates greater evils. The church isn't categorically prohibited, you know, the possession or use of nuclear weapons, but it does appear that their use would contradict the idea of just war theory.
Trent Horn is our guest. His brand new book, What the Saints Never Said, is available at shop.catholic.com. We're talking about which Catholic moral teachings do you reject? If there's something that you reject in the moral teaching of the church, 888-31-TRUTH is the number. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with your calls after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Trent Horn. Did you know that you can have me and other Catholic Answers speakers headline your next conference or parish event? Go to CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com to get all the information you need to book one of our dynamic speakers today. That's CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com.
God helps those who help themselves. Preach the gospel always. When necessary, use words. Sayings like these are such a part of tradition that we assume they come from the Bible, the saints, or famous Christian writers, even though nobody can seem to place their origin. By sheer repetition, they have acquired a halo of truth. In What the Saints Never Said, Trent Horn takes over 40 of these well-known but actual dubious sayings and attempts to track them to their true source. The result? He finds some that are close to what was really said, many that were misattributed or twisted beyond their original meaning, and more than a few that were just plain made up. By setting the record straight, Trent roots out theological errors that can lead us away from Christian truth and offers authentic quotes from Scripture, saints, and scholars that will draw you closer to that truth. Get your copy of What the Saints Never Said today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Great, big, huge, giant Monday show. Trent Horn is our guest. Trent, fresh off his pilgrimage with 45 pilgrims to the Holy Land. Still recovering from that. So go easy. No, you don't have to go easy on Trent. You never have to go easy on Trent. The topic this hour: which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? 888-31-TRUTH is the number, 888-318-7884. Let us start with Chip in Michigan, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio. Chip, you are on with Trent Horn. Your question, please. Or, no, I'm sorry. What moral teaching do you reject?
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, are you right up next to the phone there, Chip?
I'm driving right now, so...
Okay, we got you. We're good. All right, go ahead.
Oh, great, great. Yeah. I don't know if I'd say the word reject. How about massively confused by Amoris Laetitia, where Pope Francis teaches that people who are living in permanent and public adultery can receive Holy Communion. I find that teaching to be massively confusing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just something I have a difficult time accepting.
Okay. Sure thing, Chip. What I would recommend, that if you want to go into this in more detail, because there's a lot that could be said about that, and actually a lot of it's already been said by my colleague, Tim Staples. He has a series of articles that go into the question in depth that I think would be very satisfying. So just look up Tim Staples, "Is Pope Francis a Heretic?" And he goes through Amoris Laetitia and this particular question about administering communion, allowing those who are divorced, remarried, they are remarried, engaging in sexual relations with their new spouse, and they have not annulled their previous marriage, so they would be committing the sin of adultery. Can they receive communion or not? And what Pope Francis, all that Pope Francis is saying in the encyclical is that there can be cases where a priest can determine in the internal forum, a priest can determine when they're speaking with this person, that the person may be guilty of sin, but it may not be a mortal sin. So there could be, and Tim provides an example in his article of a woman who is remarried. So she lives in a very impoverished country, for example, and marriage is a way for, you know, her to provide for her children so they're not destitute and near starvation or, you know, in desperate situation. And so she's married to someone, has children with them, but she wants to live the church's teaching. And she fears, though, that if she withholds sexual relations from a spouse who is abusive or controlling, he may hurt the children or he may leave her. And so it places an overwhelming amount of stress on her that could question whether she's culpable or, you know, freely engaging in relations with him. So essentially, that's what it's talking about here, is that could there be cases where there are people who are divorced, remarried, but there are extenuating circumstances that lessen the gravity of the adultery that they're committing. And perhaps there are, and if those render the situation that they're in to be venial rather than mortal, then that person could receive communion. But that would be up to a priest to be able to determine what situation that person is in. So I would recommend that in order to go into this in a deeper level, check out Tim's article, Is Pope Francis a Heretic? You can just search for it online. And he'll go into a lot of questions and follow-up that relates to this subject and going into the text at a deeper level. So I hope that will be helpful for you, and thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Chip. We move now to Ivan, or Yvonne, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, in Charleston, South Carolina, listening on 7:30 a.m. Which way do you pronounce it?
Ivan.
Ivan. Okay, Ivan, you are on with Trent Horn. Your question.
Good evening. I'm not really opposed to the idea, but I'm very confused, like the previous caller, that suffering may be good for the individual, especially when suffering occurs to children or maybe even babies. I don't know if you heard about the Syrian attack on their own people where babies and children were hurt. And they were exposed to hypochloric gases. And these children were suffering. And then what kind of good could come of something like that, especially when it's a child or somebody who you would think is innocent?
Sure. And this goes back to the problem of suffering and evil. One of the biggest problems all people have faced to believe in God, well, really all people face in general, is what to do with evil and suffering. So one answer to the problem is that, well, evil and suffering occur because life is meaningless and you feel pain and then you die and that's it. Though I think for many people, you know, they wonder why God could allow suffering. They have to keep in mind that that's if they reject God or question whether God is good because of evil and suffering, that's really the only answer that's left. That's the only one that's left. If you throw out God, then evil is a result of just a meaningless life. But most people believe life has meaning. There's intrinsic dignity. People deserve to be treated a certain way. We're outraged by moral evil, that you ought not behave in this such a way. You're not just a mere animal. You know, you have an immortal soul. You have free will. You can choose to do right. You ought to do right. So your question is, how could suffering, especially of innocence, like children or babies, how could suffering be good? And my answer to that is, first, suffering in and of itself is not a good. Goodness is a lack of being. Pope St. John Paul II actually wrote a very good encyclical on suffering called Salvifici Doloris. And he says in there, man suffers on account of evil, which is a certain lack, limitation, or distortion of good. We could say that a man suffers because of a good in which he does not share. So suffering in and of itself is not a good. It's an absence of some kind of good. So when people say suffering is good, I think it's more what they mean is suffering can lead to goods, or God can bring good about more good even in light of suffering. Now, how could he do that? Well, first, in this life, evil that occurs in suffering could happen because God brings more goods from that, you know, goods like free will. We are freely able to love and cherish one another. The freedom to be able to love also includes the freedom to hate and commit deplorable acts of hate, like war crimes. So, I mean, if you think what's awful, what's terrible with human beings, not terrible, but it's hard that when you think of the highest acts of charity and selflessness humans exhibit to one another, there's sort of an evil twin of a base, evil, monstrous thing we can do to one another. C.S. Lewis used this example. He said, you know, as an animal gets more and more intelligent, there's a greater distance between the good and evil that it does. So if you think of like a cow, like, you know, a cow can, it munches on grass, it does good. What evil does it do? Maybe it kicks you if it doesn't like how you're milking them. But there's a very narrow difference between a good cow and a bad cow. When you get more, like a dog, you know, dogs are a bit smarter. There's good dogs that play fetch and bad dogs that bite at your leg. Human beings, there's Mother Teresa's and there's Adolf Hitler's. And then if you think of angels, there's the Archangel Michael and there's the devil. I mean, so with humans, that the fact that we can love and do so much good, that's because we have this freedom, and that freedom can be used for bad things. But God can redeem all of this because there's both goods he brings in this life and goods in the next life. So that God, if someone is a victim of evil in this life, like little babies or children, God can compensate them with an infinite amount of happiness in the next life. So that if God gives us infinite happiness, that will outweigh anything we might have suffered in this life, and God can still bring overwhelming good in the face of any evil he allows. So my friend Jimmy Akin actually has a good DVD on this called The Problem of Evil that I'd recommend as another resource. But is that at least a helpful start to, I know it can't be an end because it's a big question, but is that a helpful start to the question?
Yes, that does help. Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Okay, good.
Ivan, thanks very, very much for the call. Again, if you have a Catholic moral teaching that you disagree with, today is your day. 888-318-7884, the number. We go now to Matt in Houston, Texas, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite 130. Matt, you are on with Trent Horn.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your taking my call.
Happy to have you here.
Oh, great. Thank you. My question involves euthanasia and the specific circumstance, and this comes from acquaintances and family members that have had mental illness as they aged quite a bit and became elderly, such that they just weren't the same person that they were previously, were going through a tremendous discomfort and pain. And in fact, people who would want to leave a legacy, a resource, perhaps financial, to their family, but over years of being treating a person that they're just not quite there yet. And if that person had previously stated, listen, if I'm ever in that situation, let me go. Pull the trigger for me, because I wouldn't want to be in that torturous situation. I wouldn't want to be a burden. And the other aspect is, by not following someone else's wishes, I would feel like I was almost participating in their discomfort.
Sure.
What do you think about that, please?
Okay. Here's what the Catechism teaches on euthanasia and assisted suicide. In paragraph 2277, it says, an act or omission which of itself or by intention causes death in order to eliminate suffering constitutes a murder gravely contrary to the dignity of the human person. So what the Church teaches is not that you have to sustain a person's life through any means necessary. In fact, the very next paragraph in the Catechism, 2278, says that it's okay to discontinue burdensome, dangerous, disproportionate care that doesn't provide a benefit to the patient, but is very costly, whether financially, physically, or emotionally. So you can discontinue disproportionate care, but you can't directly kill people. So you definitely can't pull the trigger. That would constitute directly killing somebody. When it comes to pulling the plug, which is a euphemism to describe discontinuing treatment, it's permissible to do that for extraordinary care, something that's not providing the patient benefit and is very costly. But if it's an ordinary thing people have a right to, like food, water, comfort care, proper heating or ventilation in a hospital room. All human beings have a right to those things, and you can't starve someone to death just because they're disabled or they're have a different physical condition than us. So that's the church's teaching. And I would just say, Matt, in that question, that if someone asks us to do something for them, sometimes we might have to say no, right? Like, let's say somebody said, you know, somebody asked you just like, hey, my girlfriend broke up with me. Life's not worth living anymore. I'm too much of a weakling to kill myself. So will you help me? You would tell them, no, I'm not going to help you do something that's bad for you. And the same is true for someone who becomes disabled. We should care and help the disabled, not kill them. We should be compassionate and help them through their sufferings, not kill them to end their sufferings. Go to the National Catholic Bioethics Center for more on these important questions.
Thanks, Matt. We'll be right back with more with Trent Horn on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Catholic Answers Live. Learn to love your work and love God through it with Sanctify Your Daily Life by Stefan Cardinal Wyszynski, new from EWTN Publishing. This book will help you transform your work into a source of strength, holiness, and joy. Begin your journey with Sanctify Your Daily Life, the latest release from EWTN Publishing, now available at EWTNRC.com.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and you've probably heard me explain Catholicism to non-Catholic callers on the radio or engage opponents in formal public debates. I've always hoped these interactions would show people how to graciously defend and share our faith, but they're not enough. That's why I've created a weekly podcast that will help Catholics answer the toughest objections against our faith. Every episode of the Council of Trent will provide listeners with a conversation roadmap that will help them share their faith with anyone. Keep in mind that I hate boring lectures. These podcasts will contain entertaining, informative, and practical explanations of the faith, as well as interviews with the best Catholic writers and speakers in the world today. Visit TrentHornPodcast.com today to find out how you can subscribe to my new podcast. That's TrentHornPodcast.com.
The world is changing. The days of picking up a paperback book or popping a DVD or compact disc in the player have given way to the digital age. The good news is that the shop at Catholic.com has joined the digital revolution. Check out the new digital platform at shop.catholic.com, where all of our DVDs, books, and audio products are now available in digital form for you to purchase and download at your convenience, anywhere you go. For that matter, anywhere in the world. We've got hundreds of offerings, so visit shop.catholic.com today and check out our selection. That's shop.catholic.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn is here for this entire Monday with us. We're so happy to have Trent here with us. And the topic for the hour, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? Is there a Catholic moral teaching that you've just said, nope, I can't go that far with the church? Maybe you're in a process where you will at some point be able to go that far with the church. Maybe you feel like, no way, I'll never go there. Whatever that whatever stage you feel you are in with that, we'd love to hear from you. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I do want to let you know that we talked about it right at the beginning, What the Saints Never Said, Pious Misquotes and the Subtle Heresies They Teach You, Trent's latest book. It's on sale right now. You can get 15% off at shop.catholic.com. Everything's on sale. Sorry, Trent, I didn't mean to make it. Everything at shop.catholic.com is at sale. But you're going to definitely want to get What the Saints Never Said. You just could use promo code SPRING18 at checkout. Use promo code SPRING18 at checkout and get everything on sale, 15% off. That's good, though, Trent. I mean, it's not just that your book is on sale. They threw everything else in there on sale as well.
That's a lot of good stuff. Glad to get it out there.
Whitney in Oklahoma, listening on 97.3 FM. You are on with Trent Horn. Which Catholic moral teaching do you reject?
I've been having some trouble with the teaching of contraception. Mm-hmm.
What are you concerned about?
Well, specifically, like, when a married couple has a child, and their first child has some sort of, like, genetic disorder, and it's likely that all of the rest of subsequent children they would have would also have that genetic disorder. Mm-hmm. What is the Catholic teaching in that specific instance?
Sure. Well, the Church's teaching is that you cannot do something that's intrinsically evil in order to secure a good. And so the Church has taught that contraception is an intrinsic evil. And the reason it is because the marital act is for the unitive and procreative purposes of the spouses. The marital act between husband and wife should be a full and complete gift of self between them. If they sterilize that act in any way, it ceases to communicate that marital love. And it becomes just a means of extracting pleasure, emotional comfort. It ceases to have the marital meaning God intended for it. But that doesn't mean that you can't take steps in certain situations to space children or refrain from having children for just reasons. So when we look in the Catechism and other church documents, couples can space children using natural means like natural family planning for just reasons. They may not be able to provide for children right now. I think it would also be a just reason if you felt that, well, there's a high probability the child that will be conceived will have a severe congenital defect. And so if there's a high probability for that, that could constitute a just reason to space children. I've seen this and similar cases among my married friends. I know some people who the wife has had a very severe medical condition or reaction from a previous pregnancy. And so they have chosen to use natural family planning to indefinitely postpone having children because of the grave consequences that could result. Now, I think what some people will think is, well, why not just use contraception? Well, remember, if something's intrinsically evil, we can't use it even for a good reason. So just as, for example, if abortion is intrinsically wrong, it's always wrong to directly kill an unborn child, that doesn't become right even if we used abortion because the child who was conceived has some kind of genetic defect. So if contraception is as intrinsically evil as abortion, we can't use it to try to promote the good of not conceiving a child with this kind of defect. So I would say that while it's very difficult, there are other means that can be taken into account to space children if someone is aware of this, and to look at other medical methods to maybe look into preventing passing on certain genes or things like that. And I know there's actually some good articles on this question at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Their website is ncbcenter.org. So I think that might be helpful. But just to resummarize, contraception is wrong because it violates the meaning of the marital act. And we can't use something that's evil in and of itself, like abortion or contraception, to achieve something that's good. We have to find another way. So is that at least a helpful response?
Yes. Can I ask one quick follow-up question?
Sure.
How is natural family planning different or better or less evil, I guess, than like physical forms of preventing pregnancy that aren't hormonal birth control and aren't IUDs?
Right. Here's the difference. What contraception does, contraception is an action. It's something you do to sterilize the marital act or put a barrier between husband and wife. So the goal of the marital act, what it is ordered towards, is for husband and wife to become one flesh. That's what it says in the book of Genesis. It says, you know, a man will leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And Jesus says the same thing in Matthew 19. They become one flesh. But in order to become one flesh, and I apologize if this might sound crude to people, you can't just put one body part in another. You know, when the dentist inserts his fingers into my mouth for an oral exam, we have not become one flesh. Becoming one flesh involves two people, incomplete on their own, being ordered towards something greater outside of themselves. And husband and wife, that happens when their reproductive systems, incomplete on their own, when they're united in the marital act, are ordered towards a new human life that may come into existence. So this marital act has to be ordered towards that goal, and there can't be a barrier placed between husband and wife. The marital act should be a full, free, total gift of self between the spouses. I fully give my whole self to you, my mind, body, even my fertility. So if you have a latex barrier, if you use hormonal contraception that prevents eggs from being released during this time, you're acting in a way to keep the spouses apart. You're acting in a way to sterilize this marital act. Natural family planning, you do not do anything to sterilize the marital act. Natural family planning is just a combination of two things: abstinence, or not engaging in marital relations, and engaging in marital relations, but without using anything that sterilizes it. You just give your whole selves to one another. Now, you, through natural family planning, know when someone is naturally fertile or infertile, and God gave us those natural fertile and infertile times, but you're not doing anything to change the nature of the act itself. Whereas with contraception, you turn a life-giving act into a barren act. Natural family planning, you're just honoring the naturally fertile and infertile times of marital intercourse that God has given us. Contraception, you do something to sterilize the act. NFP, you're just, the husband and wife give themselves to one another at different times, rejoicing in the gift God gave them, whether it's fertile intimacy or infertile intimacy. So is that a helpful difference?
Yes.
Okay. Whitney, thank you so much. I very much appreciate that call. Trent Horn is our guest this hour. Our topic, which Catholic moral teachings do you reject or teaching? If there's one that's given you trouble, if there's one you've just given up on, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Let's go to Len in Pennsylvania, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio. Len, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject?
Good to talk with you. I'm having difficulty finding logical consistency in the Church's prohibition against priests getting married. When St. Peter was married, I understand that certain popes were married, and the Church allows certain priests who are ordained outside of our denomination to become Catholics while they're married and become priests.
Mm-hmm. Good question. I will say first that the Church's teaching on priestly celibacy is not a doctrine. It is a discipline. It is a way of living or a rule of life that the Church has given to some priests who serve the Church. So this rule, for example, you're correct. It did not apply in the early Church, though. It didn't apply universally. There were still many cases of individuals and regional councils that we see requiring celibacy or prohibiting those who are widowed to be able to serve, for example, in different orders. What I'm thinking about is in 1 Timothy 5:12, St. Paul talks about how some female religious violated their first pledge, which could refer to vows of celibacy. But in general, the Church's teaching on celibacy now is a discipline. So priests in the Latin Rite are required to be celibate, whereas priests in the Eastern Church are not. They can be married. They can't get married after they are ordained, but if they are a married man, they can be ordained to the priesthood. And if my memory serves me correctly, bishops in the Eastern Church cannot be married. So these are different disciplines that have been given for different goods for the Church. And I would say that the good of celibacy, there's a lot of good behind it because it allows priests to be able to serve the Lord and serve the body of Christ in ways that would be difficult for a married person to do that. And I think a scriptural justification we find for this would be in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. There, St. Paul talks about marriage and celibacy, and he says, I wish everyone could be celibate like me. He praises celibacy. And there's a particular line in 1 Corinthians 7 where St. Paul says that the unmarried man is anxious about things of the Lord, while the married man is anxious about the things of this world, particularly pleasing his wife and his family. So this is a discipline the Church has given so that priests are able to serve the Church in a more direct and a more faithful manner. It's not a universal law, but it's something that helps promote. Also, one more thing that I would add is that the priest in living a celibate life is able to more clearly represent Jesus, that the priest stands in the person of Christ in the sacraments. And of course, Jesus was celibate. The Church is his bride. And so this allows the Church to essentially be the bride of the priest, and the Church serves the priest in this. The priest serves the Church in a way like how Christ serves the church. So is that a helpful explanation?
I understand what you're saying, and I guess it's not a proper form to debate it, but I guess my short response would be that I think your question sort of presupposes that the unmarried priest is more likely to be a better type of representation of Christ on the earth, whereas a married person might be more concerned with raising his family and children. I guess I wouldn't be prepared to make that blanket statement. I've met married priests that have been better priests in every aspect of the word than single priests and vice versa. So, again, I don't mean to debate you. I'll tell you where I'm coming from.
Len, I see what you're saying. And whenever we talk about general principles or things that are generally true, there's always going to be exceptions. Like, you know, married people are usually better with children than unmarried people. But you can find unmarried people who are great with children and married people that are just awful with them. So there's always going to be exceptions. But what I'm drawing from is not just merely a general observation, which I think still holds out for the unmarried and how they're able to serve versus a married person and the commitments that they have. I'm just citing a biblical reference to this, that St. Paul himself in 1 Corinthians 7 makes this practical judgment. And so the church, in making this teaching, is following him in that regard of talking about how those who are not entangled in the things of this world, they're just more freed up to be able to serve God. If you like, I'd recommend going to our website at Catholic.com, and you can see more of the justifications for the church's teaching on celibacy and how the priest, in representing Christ, can lead people to Christ when he chooses an unmarried life and chooses to essentially be wed to the church, which is the bride of Christ. But thanks for calling.
Len, thank you very, very much. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. Which Catholic social teaching do you reject with Trent Horn right after this?
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our fifth annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there.
We've had a wonderful time going home all enthused.
Every time we come here, it's just an incredible experience.
Normally, you'd have to root through a dozen different books to get half the stuff I've learned here.
These guys are so amazing. I always get so much, learn so much. I've already signed up for next year.
Join us this September 27th to the 30th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. All of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and special keynote speaker, Raymond Leo Cardinal Burke.
I enjoy the atmosphere and the friendliness of the people, and I'm having a great time.
I love it. I love it. I'm so glad I came here.
I've just learned so much. You know, I've been a Catholic all my life. It's just been so wonderful.
I love it. I want to come back every year.
Did you know that Catholic Answers Live is on TV? What began as a monthly series on EWTN in April of 2017 is now going to be coming to you on a weekly basis. You can catch Catholic Answers Live TV Saturdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on EWTN with an encore at 2:30 a.m. on Sundays. We'll also be available soon on Apple TV, Roku, and the Augustine Institute's multimedia platform, Form. Make a point of making Catholic Answers Live TV part of your weekly viewing, and we'll see you on the airwaves.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn's our guest for 2 hours today. And we're planning on wearing them out. So call with your toughest questions for Trent, and we're going to wear him out because he's been flying internationally in recent days. So we know we've already got a head start on wearing him out. 888-318-7884 is the number. Which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? I think I said social teaching on the way out to the break, but I meant to say moral teaching do you reject? Is there something the Catholic Church holds as a moral truth or as a moral directive, as a moral requirement that you say, no, I cannot accept that, that I just don't see how that could possibly be true? 888-318-7884. Let's go to Kyle in California, watching on Facebook Live. Kyle, thanks for watching on Facebook. You are on with Trent Horn.
Hello there. Thanks for having me on, guys. So I disagree with the idea that all same-sex acts are intrinsically evil. First of all, I think that language is unnecessarily harsh to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. And who and how we love others doesn't have to be heterosexual to be valid or holy. I don't agree with that idea. Straight married couples can be infertile. You guys have talked about this already. Gay married couples can and do adopt and raise children. I mean, it's happening in millions of families across the country and the world. I think we can treat gay people like we would naturally treat, or like we would treat naturally infertile couples, because they are product of God's design. Unless the Catholic position is that homosexual people are broken heterosexuals and that our sexuality is disordered because it's not heterosexuality. And I'm just wondering if you could unpack that a bit and let me know why exactly it would be moral and holy and just for my sister to fall in love with and marry a man, but not for me to do the exact same thing. And I'm sure it's going to involve the definition of marriage, so I look forward to hearing what you have to say about it.
Thank you, Kyle.
Okay,
Trent. Well,
sure, I'd be happy to talk with you about that, Kyle. First, I'm very hesitant about using labels like homosexual and heterosexual to place people within boxes. I think what's more appropriate to say that there are men and women. God creates men and women, and we each have different sexual attractions, and those attractions can be ordered towards a good end, or they can be ordered towards a bad end. So you have a married man, for example. He has sexual attractions to his wife. Those are good attractions. He might have sexual attractions to other women he's not married to. Those are bad attractions. In some cases, people can have the order or disorder of one's attractions can exist on a spectrum. Some sexual attractions are more disordered when they stray from the proper ordering of what they should be. So I think that's the first question we have to talk about when we talk about the issue of sexual ethics and homosexuality, relations between men and women, two men and two women. What is sex for? When is sex ordered and when is it disordered? I wouldn't use the phrase, you know, like you're a someone with same-sex attractions is a broken heterosexual or something like that. I also wouldn't say that, you know, two men who engage in sexual behavior with one another, that they are an infertile couple. To be infertile, because in many cases, those men, if they engage in relations with women, could probably have children. That they're to be infertile means that there is something physiologically wrong with your body or the body of your spouse that prevents a child from coming into existence. Yet, in many cases, with two women or two men engaging in relations, there's nothing physiologically wrong with their bodies. They're just engaging in behavior that does not have procreation as an end. So it doesn't make sense to talk about fertile or infertile because they're not ordered towards anything related to procreation. So I'd like to bracket that point before we move on. But do you see what I'm saying there?
Yes, I think that makes sense. Except for all the heterosexual couples that have sex without having children and all the LGBT couples who actually do raise children, which I think is the end of procreation, whereas procreation is kind of a means to the end of raising children, if that makes any sense.
Well, raising children is a part of procreating them, but normally we would say they go hand in hand, that you procreate a child and then you raise the child you procreate. It's usually only through some kind of act of evil, like a natural death or separation of spouses or some kind of other suffering or evil that prevents those who procreate a child from raising that child. And I'll say to you, I'm not opposed in principle to two people of the same sex raising a child. I mean, I could imagine a situation where nuns in a convent, you know, two nuns raise a street child in a convent in India. And I'm glad that child has two people to care for him in that situation. They don't have a mother and father, but at least they have two people to care for them. So I'm not opposed in principle to two people the same sex raising a child. The concern I have is about whether sexual behavior is disordered or not, and if that is bad for us. So the church's teaching on homosexuality would go from this, that if we look at sex, even if we look at it from strictly a natural law perspective, we would see that it's ordered towards two ends, the unity of the spouses, and it's ordered towards procreation. You know, a man and woman might engage in relations. They may not conceive a child. Not everything may go right, but they're still ordered towards that end. Otherwise, what is sex for? So I guess, well, Kyle, let me go at it this way with you. Can you identify a besides rape, are there any other sexual behaviors that you would say are disordered?
Have we agreed on a definition of the term disordered? Because I'm not sure we've agreed on that yet.
Disordered is a way of acting that's unhealthy. It's a way that you should not act. It's an incorrect use of the body, I would say. An unhealthy or incorrect use of the body. Disordered.
But you're talking sexually, so I would say something like promiscuity or, I don't know, orgies, polygamy, things that increase health risks to people.
Wait. Okay. This is good. Why would polygamy? So let's say a man wants to have two wives. Why would that be disordered?
Oh, well, I don't think you can make any biblical case that it is disordered in the first place.
I'm not making a biblical case. Kyle, you were the one who offered that as an example. I'm asking why.
Oh, okay. Well, I would just say that because it allows rich people, it allows people who have more wealth to basically care for and provide for more women, and it doesn't allow poor people to care for those women that the rich people are providing for.
You see polygamy not as a sexual disorder, it's more of an economic injustice. Okay. Let's try a more basic one. Do you think someone, and I apologize for the crassness, but I have to pick examples that most people agree with, that it would be sexually disordered for a person to be attracted to and want to have relations with inanimate objects or animals?
Yes, I think that would be disordered precisely because it constitutes a mental health issue or it's unhealthy for the person engaging in those practices.
Why? Let's say a person wants to have a doll, so to speak, or whatever it might be. Why in particular would that be disordered?
Well, I'm not a mental health professional, but I know that there are increased risks of certain diseases being passed between humans and animals. If you're talking the immorality of bestiality, or why I might think that's disordered.
Okay, well, here's how I'm going to respond, because we don't have a lot of time left. The reason I bring that up is I think most people know when they see that, they say, nope, human beings are supposed to have relations with humans, not with animals, not with objects. But why? Well, when you just look at humans, we're made to go together. A man and woman are made to go together, and it ends towards some kind of the goal of procreation. You see the anatomy of men, the anatomy of women, they go together. We say, well, humans and animals don't go together. Humans and objects don't go together. To me, if you're arguing, well, there's a greater health risk involved, I think that can cut against your case, because studies have shown that there are greater health risks for men who engage in relations with other men. Have you heard about that?
I have, and I'd also like to say real quick that bestiality kind of takes away the idea of consent, that in bestiality or even in pedophilia, one party is not going to consent to sex. Did you know black men are at increased risk for AIDS? Does that mean when black people have sex or interracial marriages, we call those immoral or evil too?
But Kyle, I'm not arguing that mere risk for disease is what constitutes whether something is moral or immoral. I think that the risks of disease can be a clue as to whether something is moral or immoral. But I think what you're saying is, well, if two people can just consent, then what does it matter? Yet you're not willing to say that just a certain behavior, that a certain behavior just is disordered in and of itself, irregardless of the risks that are involved. And I think most people can see that when people engage in sexual relations that have no procreative end to them, when they're non-human, then that helps us see among human beings, where is there something disordered here, where there's not a procreative end, like with things like masturbation or homosexual behavior. When you take the procreative end of sexuality out, I think disorder comes right in. So thank you, Kyle, for calling in.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry that we got to go so quickly, but we are at the top of the hour. Trent Horn is our guest. 888-31-TRUTH is our number. Our topic this hour and next hour, which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? If there's a Catholic moral teaching, whether about sex or money or war or violence, that you have trouble with, give us a call, 888-318-7884. Be right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.